Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. I'm Darilyn Evans, and my co-host is James Stiegel. Today we're talking with Bill Cameron. He's the author of The Skin Dash Mysteries, County Line, Day One, Chasing Smoke, and Lost Dog. His stories have appeared in publications like Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Portland Noir. In 2012, County Line won the Spotted Owl for Best Northwest Mystery. His latest book is the young adult mystery, Property of the State. Bill lives in Oregon, where he enjoys craft beer and bird watching. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you. How you doing?
Welcome, Bill.
Great. So well, are the craft beer and bird watching, do those happen at the same time?
They sometimes do. You go out for bird watching, you work up a good sweat, and then you stop at the brew pub on the way home to think over what you've seen and taste something really good.
That sounds very Oregonian.
Oh, yes.
Well, you joke about working up a sweat, but you have to find those birds, and that can often be tough.
Sometimes, yeah. You know, we'll go on hikes that can, I mean, we'll do 15-mile hikes sometimes to get into some good spots. So it can be, for as mellow as the actual watching part is, it can be, you know, quite an endeavor.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to talk about your new book, Property of the State. Can you tell us a little bit about just the book itself?
Well, Property of the State is the story of Joey Getchy, who is a 16-year-old foster kid who has been kicked around through various foster placements for his entire life. And it's in the course of the book, he is falsely accused of basically surfing the web with his school-issued computer for porn, and gets into a huge fight with his foster father and ends up running away. And while he is running away, he ends up staying in secret in the home of a family that he does odd jobs for, and they don't know that he's there. And so I kind of think of it as its original inspiration was maybe the mixed up files of Mrs. Basilea Frankweiler, but it's a little older, it's a little grittier, and rather than the mystery that the kids found in that book, the mystery that he discovers as he's living with this family is quite a bit darker. So it's maybe Mrs. Frankweiler meets Rear Window.
Well, congrats on the Starred Kirkus review.
Thank you.
That is really awesome.
Yeah, I was floored and thrilled by that.
Very exciting.
Yes.
You mentioned gritty, and one of the things that really jumped out at me, you know, a lot of YA just seems like simpler adult. You know, it's characters that don't have to deal with real problems, and Joey definitely does deal with real problems, and really read to me as I live with a 14-year-old and interact with a lot of 14 to 16-year-olds, and it's just amazing the things that they're dealing with. One thing I was really curious about is how, you know, in developing a character, how do you make sure that you're still within YA, but you're kind of skirting that line on what is real, what is gritty, what is heartfelt, without getting into, you know, darker territory.
Right. Well, really, my feeling about darkness is that it's not something that I worry about. I think that kids live in the same world that adults live in, and they, we may, as adults, we may want to shield them from the reality of the world around them, but all too often, you know, our best efforts fail. And so kids have to deal with plenty of stuff, and it's not, there's just no natural filter out there. And so I feel like I want to talk about how does a kid deal with the kinds of situations that will sometimes even wipe out, an adult.
Yeah.
Plenty of adults can, can fail with dealing with less than someone like Joey dealt with. And, you know, and I think that the YA, it's an incredibly broad genre, if you even want to call it a genre. And certainly there's lots of really great YA that's out there right now that, you know, it pulls no punches. It's kids dealing with the kinds of problems that they have to deal with. And I just felt like I don't have to worry about the darkness. I just have to worry about making sure that my character is a teenager, not just a slightly less old adult.
Right.
And, you know, that's really the challenge, I think.
One thing I thought about is that this is a book that teenagers will love. I don't know if parents will. That was one thing. But, I don't know, my son said he wanted to read it, so I was excited about that.
Good.
Has there been any marketing issues with that, or does the publisher, they're totally behind it? And...
The publisher is completely fine with it. The one thing that the publisher did, probably it was just the nod to the seriousness of the content, is on the back it says young adult for older teens. So they definitely are targeting kids that are a little bit older. And obviously, there's a wide range of sophistication and maturity among readers. And some readers, can reach a sophisticated reading level very young. Some may be a little older. I mean, there's some, very, very old people that probably, couldn't handle a story like this, or a story like a lot of the YA books that are out there. Once again, I mean, I see it as it's a book about a teen, and it's certainly for teens first, but I really consider the audience is anybody that wants to read about the experiences, of a young person. And that means, any age, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Certainly I read a lot of young adult, and I'm a grandpa.
Well, it helps you relate. Well, now that we've built up all this suspense, would you be able to read an excerpt?
Sure. So what I've chosen is, it's actually in the second chapter, and so I'll do a little bit of setup first. Joey, in the first chapter, is called into his principal's office, where he is confronted with the accusation that he has used his school computer to visit quote-unquote inappropriate websites. And he's already made clear in his own mind that he thinks that his foster father did it, that his foster father requires access to his computer to quote-unquote check on his assignments. And Joey has a very dicey relationship with his foster father, Wayne. And so after the meeting at school, his Department of Human Services, Children's and Family Services caseworker, takes him back to the house, and she has stopped in with Joey and with Wayne, the foster father, because she says, after what has come up, she wants to do a spot check. And so I'm going to read the spot check in Joey's room. So they're at the house of the Bobbitt family, who Joey lives with, and Wayne is the foster father, and Mrs. Petty is his caseworker. My room, a narrow cell with a sloped ceiling, is spotless. Not much to mess up. There are no pictures or posters on the walls, no books except a student dictionary, an ancient encyclopedia set, and a Bible I've never opened. The twin bed is made to Wayne's Marine Corps standards, the itchy olive drab blanket taut across the thin mattress. The dresser is steel-framed pressboard. Socks are rolled in the top drawer, shorts folded in the second, shirts and pants below. I have a few items hanging in the shallow closet. The desktop holds only a tensor lamp and a mug filled with pencils. I'm pretty sure Wayne comes in and sharpens them while I'm gone. Mrs. Petty flicks the tensor lamp on and off, then glances in the closet and pulls open my dresser drawers. Wayne folds his arms and makes his drill sergeant face. I check the drawers and closet for food every day. She and I both know stashing food is so 9 years ago. She throws him a side eye he doesn't catch, then kneels to tap along the baseboards. When she hears a hollow spot, she looks back at me and pulls a Leatherman tool from her pocket, opens the flathead screwdriver. She slips the head into a narrow gap between the wall and the top of the baseboard. The 2-foot section clatters onto the bare wood floor. Wayne draws a breath. Behind the baseboard, I've cut away the drywall to reveal a shallow space framed with thin slats of pine. The wall studs are on 16-inch setters, making the space a little more than a foot wide, 3 inches deep, and 4 inches high, as big as I could make it and still hide it behind the baseboard. Mrs. Petty stands up. Empty. Should I be pleased or keep looking? This particular hidey hole is a gimme. I've never used it. There are a couple of others in the room, one pretty easy to find if she wants to, one I hope she'll miss. A sneak! A vein stands out on Wayne's forehead. Mrs. Petty seems less concerned. How long has this been here, Joey? I shrug. She knows better than to ask me questions like that. She turns to Wayne. I see it as a good sign. At least it's not stuffed with chocolate. I've never hoarded candy, as she knows. I look at the barred window. For security, allegedly, the key hangs on a hook on the wall. But as soon as Mrs. Petty leaves, Wayne will retrieve it. He doesn't want me sneaking out at night, or, apparently, escaping if the house ever catches fire. A shadow pressure of fear constricts my chest at the thought. I shove it down again and focus on the smoke detector on the ceiling above the window. Mrs. Petty spends a few minutes tapping the walls without finding anything of interest. I'm not surprised when she unplugs the tensor light and tries it in the one unused outlet in the room. just as she isn't surprised when the light doesn't work. She uses her screwdriver to remove the faceplate. The plug assembly, unwired, swings out on hinges. The space behind it is much smaller than the space behind the baseboard, an ordinary PVC electrical box. Mrs. Petty reaches inside and pulls out a USB thumb drive. "What's this?" She waves the seemingly innocuous object at me, like I'd tell her what's actually on it. Wayne's collection of internet porn? This is how I end up in trouble. Sometimes a smart-ass remark is worth the look on their faces, no matter the blowback afterwards.
One of the things that I love about your work is how voice-driven it is, and this story in particular really captures that smart-ass attitude, but also that kind of protective aspect of Joey, and he just really sounds like a modern teenage boy. And I'm curious how you captured that.
You know, voices, it's probably the trickiest thing that people deal with, and it's absolutely critical in young adult. And, you know, the first thing that I try to do whenever I'm writing, you know, from a point of view of younger characters, is I don't try to write the way sort of society imagines young people to communicate. And in essence, it's like if any time you see a catchphrase, if it's made it onto TV, it's already passé among young people. And so really, I try to avoid doing any of those kinds of tics and whatnot that, you know, that you see out in the world. And I try to think in terms instead of what's kind of a bare bones approach to language. And then I give the characters a few things that belong to themselves. So Joey has a fairly good vocabulary. And he'll occasionally pop out with that vocabulary, but mostly I see him almost as having kind of a Hemingway-esque approach to his interactions with people. You know, he tends to be very direct, tends to be very short, and that internal dialogue is where you see a little bit more of, you know, of his own voice. And, you know, I think it's really important to respect your characters, and that means that even if you are a grandpa, you respect where a 16-year-old is coming from. You pay a lot of attention to the people around you. And the other thing I do, of course, I read lots of young adult books, and I prefer to focus on young adult books by people that are a lot younger than I am. I mean, certainly there's some great writers of young adult that are much older than I am, but when I'm trying to understand voice, I want to get into the head of people that are closer to this age group, because I feel like it's going to be more genuine.
So how does that work? How has it been, I guess, moving from your adult mysteries written for adults to writing YA? And you know, what's the difference for you in terms of like creating that voice and those characters and situations? I mean, this is every bit as much of, I guess, an adult situation or a adult mystery, or a mystery that would fit into an adult's life, I guess. But sure. Aside from that, like thinking about voice and character there.
Well, you know, like, as you said, I mean, this is a mystery that could certainly occur in an adult's life. And in one sense, it is a mystery that occurs in adults' lives. It's just, you know, I mean, I could have told the same exact story from the point of view of the, you know, police investigating the events of the story, and I have told adult stories about young people that were from the point of view of the adult. I think that what you have to do in that case, you have to think about what are the priorities of the character. The priorities of Joey in his case is really it's survival and escape. He's got to survive long enough until he can escape. He's really concerned with autonomy. And that's something that's very, very important to a lot of young people. I mean, when you become a teenager, you're experimenting, you're trying things out, and you're trying to get a hold of your own life. And obviously that's where a lot of conflict with parents come from, because the kids are pushing the boundaries. But that's what we, you know, that's what we all do. We did it when we were young. And so I look at a situation, it may be the same situation that an adult would tackle, but an adult's not going to tackle it from the perspective of how does it impact my autonomy. They may be more in a problem-solving frame of mind. And a lot of what Joey does in this story is he's certainly problem-solving, but he's also mostly problem-solving, you know, how do I stay out of the clutches of the authorities? And mm-hmm. It's all about that, where is he at in his life? He's a smart kid. He certainly, you know, he could go in and solve a mystery the same way an adult could if he wanted to, but why would he want to? He's got his own problem. So that's really the key. It's always thinking about what's the perspective of the character, where are they coming from, and what will be critical to them.
I love that. That is an excellent note for any, yeah. any level of writing. So.
Well, one thing I was, you know, thinking of autonomy, I sort of thought of it as Joey's sense of hope, that his hope of, a, you know, of escape, but to me, that's also tied into the system he's caught up in, and I'm wondering how much hope do you feel about the foster system? Is the novel a comment at all on that system? And is Joey's him being caught up in it, is it a are you commenting on that, or is it really just about the character?
Well, I mean, I think you can't write about anything without there being some kind of comment, and it's not like I'm trying to write a polemic. You know, that's a, you know, obviously its own kind of writing and certainly has a lot of merit. But it's certainly true that there's aspects of the foster system that probably don't look too good. You know, I mean, one of the things that I am aware of is that there are people that will read this will say, well, wait a minute, you know, this isn't my experience, or I'm a caseworker and I work really hard. And those are obviously fair reactions. In general, I've got some personal experience with the foster system, and I relied on that. And I also have some friends who, you know, have experience with the foster system, and I relied on them as well. In general, my view of the foster system is it's populated by people that are working very, very hard with extremely limited resources to deal with really big problems. And that's a huge challenge. And are there failures? Absolutely. And Joey experiences some of those failures. I don't think it's because the people that are doing the work aren't doing the best that they can with what they have available. I just think that, you know, you reach a wall. In some ways, Joey's circumstances in the foster care system are a worst case scenario, although, you know, I read some stories in the newspaper where it actually maybe not, but, you know, I'm not trying to say that Joey's experience is universal. I'm just trying to say that given the realities that the foster system has to deal with, these are the problems that will sometimes crop up for kids, and Joey happens to be one of them. But Joey also has an extremely good caseworker who's working really, really hard on his behalf. Joey isn't always aware of just how much she's doing for him, and that's a, you know, that's another factor that's it's very realistic. I mean, kids often don't recognize the hard work that you know, that adults may be doing on their behalf. And so that's one of the things that I'm trying to show with him is that where he's skating that fine line between his interpretation of events, where it's accurate and where it's inaccurate, is all dependent on his perspective on the world. And sometimes he misses things that are really critical about what people are trying to do for him. Hmm. So sort of a roundabout answer, but I think I answered part of what you said and then looped back to who Joey was. You know, in a big picture sense, I'm not trying to criticize the foster care system in any kind of big picture sense. It was just, you know, one circumstance.
No, and I think writing a character with limited knowledge in that system is a challenge, and I think this book does that really well.
Yeah. Thank you.
One thing I was curious about, so this, well, in all your mysteries, as you're developing the character, are you developing the plot in response to the character, or did you have a plot element that then the character, like, who would respond to this event, or how do those things work for you? Like, once you have the character, does the plot grow from that, and how do you grow the plot? Because character seems very central to your book. So
yeah.
That's a fair statement to make.
Yeah, I think it is. On that continuum of plot-driven versus character-driven, which really is more like an amorphous blob, it's not really a continuum, but, you know, I definitely tilt towards the character-driven side of things. You know, in this case, I had an idea for the basic setup, which is about a kid who is hiding out in someone else's house without them knowing that he's there. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, that was something that was a really interesting premise. But that's not a plot. That's just a circumstance. It's not even an inciting incident in the, you know, kind of the classical sense of the word. But then I started to ask myself, well, so what kind of kid would end up in a place like this? How would they end up there? Why would they end up there? what kinds of things would they find while they're there? And so at that point, what I'm doing is two different things. I'm thinking about plot, but I'm also thinking about the kind of character that's going to fit into this circumstance that's it's interesting to me. And so it, certainly in the case of Joey, the development of the plot and the development of the character went hand in hand. You know, I needed to create a character that was plausibly going to be able to pull off this, you know, an extremely difficult challenge of hiding in somebody's house without them knowing that he's there. Now, it helps that it's a really big house, and part of the house is unused. You know, he's got, you know, but I had to create a reason for how he would know that and how he would, you know, I had to set up all this backstory, which, you know, it's always tricky with backstory because you get bogged down in it. But, you know, I needed to know how that was going to be possible. And then once I understood that backstory, that began to point to potential plot directions that I could go. Because one of the questions that you ask, like, okay, so they live in a big house, which part of it isn't used. Why do they live there? Why is part of the house not used? What, you know, what kind of circumstances does that come from? So that's what, you know, I'm at that point, I've got some plot that's beginning to grow, but then I'm also having to build my secondary characters, my supporting characters, and it's, you know, I mean, it's really kind of an organic process that takes a long time, but really the plot drives character choices, and character decisions drive plot direction is kind of my big picture view of it.
So how long did it take you to write Property of the State? And what were you doing? Like, do you write multiple things at once, or do you have other, you know, what's your process there?
Well, Property of the State itself, it took about probably the first major, you know, from conception to a draft that I was willing to share with somebody was about a year and a half. Now, after that, I ended up doing additional revisions, and so I probably ended up spending about 2.5 years on it. In that particular case, I was mostly just writing Property of the State while I was working on it. I did do some short stories along the way that mostly happened in the spaces, like while I was having people read drafts of it, you know, I'd work on a short story. And that's actually a pretty typical time frame for me. A novel taking 2 to 2.5 years is relatively common. My first book took 11 years, but that's when it's your first book. Until somebody wants it, you can just keep working on it and working on it. But, you know, once I got into a position where I had a contract and I had some people that were asking me, well, you know, what's coming next and when is it going to get here, I sped up, which for me, you know, 2.5 years, that's pretty fast. I know a lot of writers that write 2, 3, 4 books a year, and I'm really impressed by that. I wish I could do it, and I sort of dream of a day when I might be able to get closer to that. But yeah, generally, and you know, interestingly, right now I'm working on 2 different novels at the same time, and sometimes it's from one day to the next, and that's a very, very different process for me. But they're books that aren't very similar, and so if I get an idea for one, it's not like I have to worry about overlapping voice or overlapping circumstances. I mean, they take place in very different settings, very different kinds of characters. And so I think that's why I'm able to work on 2 at once. But usually it's 1 at a time. And, you know, and I guess, you know, we'll see. I mean, things change. I think, you know, as writers, we change over time. We find new techniques that work for us. And I'm always open to trying something new. You know, I think that's really critical for writers to be willing to expand their approach and their way of thinking. So hopefully this is going to work. We'll see.
Would you call, you know, as you're answering these questions, do you, are you writing from a discovery perspective, or do you plot, are you plotting out and then working off the plot?
In the case of the 2 books that I'm working on right now, I actually have the major plot points pretty much in mind, and I have it's sort of a hybrid outline synopsis. One of them, I've got about 20 pages of what I would describe as the story elements. The other one, I've got about 5. At the same time, I am discovering as I go, and that means that you know, that document that I have, that synopsis or outline, sometimes becomes less and less relevant as I get deeper into the story. You know, a real good example is with my 4th book, County Line. I wrote a detailed outline. It's about 25 pages, and I really, you know, I was hitting beats. I was looking at, you know, all the acts, and, you know, I was really trying to follow that, you know, that rising action, you know, with setbacks and all of that. And it was a, you know, it was a really good, solid outline, and I thought that it was really helpful. And it was broken up into three parts. Part one followed the outline very closely. Part two started to veer away from the outline, and by the time I got to part three, it was very different. So on the one hand, it was, you know, I plotted. I was a plotter. But by the time I was writing the finish to it, I had shifted into pantser. And that worked really well for that book. And, you know, but with other books, it's been completely seat of the pants. It really just kind of depends on the project. I am trying now to do more pre-planning than I had done in the past. And it's partly because I know that if I write a really detailed outline and I decide to change my mind, that's okay. I showed that it worked, you know. And who did I show? I mean, I showed myself. It really, you know, that was, you know, until you actually turn it over to someone, it's all about making sure that it works for you as the writer. And that was a valuable experience to learn that I could plot and pants at the same time.
I love that. So as you're approaching plotting, how does that go for you? Or at least I should say outlining. Is it more about how the characters are developing and then you're bringing in plot points to focus on that? Or do you start, I think a lot of people, especially at the beginning, think, okay, I have to plot it and A happens and B happens and C happens and then I have to figure out how that character comes in over the top of it. Or is that just me? my early understanding of plotting versus character. Or how does that develop for you? Do you know, do you kind of have an end in mind and work backwards? Or what does outlining look like for you? And kind of what's your focus as you're diving into it?
And if, well, I could add one thing, especially with a mystery. So if we've got like specific elements that need to be added and we know what the central mystery is, that seems like something that's really difficult to pants for me. But that's what I would love to hear your take on as well.
Well, you know, it's what's interesting about mysteries, and when I, you know, I write quote unquote mysteries in a big picture sense, but in a way, each book is a little different. You know, mystery, like, you know, like all genres, mystery has its subcategories. And when I'm writing something that's closer to a whodunit, obviously you've got plot elements that are a lot more critical than if you're writing like a psychological suspense, where the plot may, you know, the plot is still important, but the character-driven aspect may be where you start. You know, my first book was probably more psychological suspense, and it did have a plot, but I wrote it almost seat of the pants because it was about exploring those characters as I went along. Of course, it took, like I said, it took me 11 years, so you know, that could be an indictment of the pantsing mode for me. You know, with my second book, it was, there was a very specific crime, and I had to plan what clues were going to be available to the investigator, Skin Kadish, and how he was going to discover them. Now, those plots were certainly, or those plot points were the result of choices made by characters, and so I needed to understand the characters, especially as I got deeper into the story. But that whole process of laying out the clues and, you know, knowing who did it, that was very, very important early on in the writing. What was really interesting is I got about three quarters of the way into the book, and you know, I'd been following my, you know, kind of those, that path of clues pretty closely, and I realized that characters were making choices along the way that ended up pointing to a different person who did it. Mm. And that had to do with the, you know, I had my plot laid out, but then the character development, as it became deeper and more, you know, more involved, I realized that the decisions I was having characters make no longer fit with the plot point. Now, suddenly, the whodunit became a completely different whodunit. You know, that meant I had to do a lot of revision, obviously, to tune those clues earlier in the process. So once again, the plot was important for me to know ahead of time, but I didn't let it constrain me because I wanted the characters to be true to themselves. And so that was, you know, once again, that can be a really fun moment, you know, when I'm working as a on a story And I thought I knew what was going on, and I realized that something else was going on completely different. And it's almost always a lot more interesting. You know, it's that, yay, I get that moment. You know, readers get that moment. You think of writers are sitting there, oh, they're just working on their stories and they know everything that's going to happen. But, you know, I think that writers get those moments of revelation too. And it can be just as exciting, if not more so.
So, so you said it took you 11 years to write that first novel. What were you doing? Like, did you decide you were going to write a novel and then start writing, or what had you done before that in terms of, I guess, learning how to write, or were you focused on short stories before that point, or what did it look like in your early days of writing and then to get to that point?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, when I say my first novel, I really mean my first book. My first book was the fourth novel that I had written, I'd written these three novels beforehand, plus lots and lots of short stories. I was, you know, I was a creative writing major in college, and, you know, followed that track. I wrote two novels while I was in college, and a third novel that was sort of started in college and then finished. It was sort of my senior project, but it took me a long time to finish it, so I wrote most of it while I wasn't going to school, and then I kind of went back and had to finish up. But, you know, essentially it was, you know, the path of learning to be a writer. You know, the first book was, it had some things about it that probably were, had some merit, but it was really raw and really clumsy and very overwrought. It was not publishable, and it wasn't even something that could eventually be edited into publishability. And it took a long time for me to accept that. But, you know, once I did, it was, you know, I saw it as, you know, a very valuable learning experience. And I appreciated it later. My second book was very experimental. I was trying things that, you know, they were really interesting from almost like the puzzle of writing. Like, how would you accomplish X? Essentially the goal of that book for me was to write a novel that was one chapter but still had different scenes, but you couldn't always tell when you had shifted into different scenes. It was, you know, it made no sense. It was impossible to understand, but it was an important experiment to me because it was how I began to play with the idea of voice in a really genuine way. I shifted scenes by shifting voice. And, once again, unpublishable, but a really valuable work experience. And then when I wrote the book that was my senior project, the real problem with it is it was mostly just way too big. It was about, at one point it was about 1,200 manuscript pages. I'm not even sure what the word count ended up being, but it just kept getting bigger and bigger and more unwieldy. But what was curious about it, in many ways, was probably the closest that I had gotten to publishability at that point, because I had begun to fine-tune my craft to the point where I could, you know, write something and somebody would read it and be like, yeah, I would like to read more, rather than, oh, do I have to fight my way through this, or can I, you know, can I stop? And, you know, so it was really valuable. And so then when I finally started the book that would become my first, you know, published book, I'd had, at that point, probably 15 years of writing study and practice, and I also had, you know, By that time, I had been working for, you know, in the real world for a while, no longer in an educational setting, and I was writing, doing commercial writing, advertisements, and packaging copy and stuff like that. So I had, you know, that kind of writing is a very different kind of writing from fiction, obviously, but it does give you, or at least it gave me, kind of some lessons in how to wrap things up. As you can see, I can go on and on. As a writer, it's that, you know, learning when you've said enough and then cutting some more almost, you know, is that can be a huge lesson. And so that was a really valuable experience for me. And then, you know, when I finally started writing Lost Dog, my first book, I didn't know it was going to be a book. I just decided that I wanted to try my hand at mystery. I loved reading mystery, but I had never written mystery to that point. And so I thought, you know, I'll just kind of see what happens. And I had taken a class in mystery writing at Portland State, and it was really fun. And it ended up turning into a book, which when I started it, I wouldn't have been surprised if it hadn't. If I would have been just like, oh, I'm going to try this, you know, this mystery novel, and oh, it didn't work, so I'm going to go back to writing fantasy and science fiction, which is what I had written up to that point. But then it did work, and I really liked it. And so now I'm at the point where I write mystery. I don't know if I'll, you know, I love fantasy and science fiction as a reader. I don't know if I'll ever go back to it as a writer. I might. Don't rule that out. But, you know, when I, where I found my voice was in that kind of mystery, crime, you know, dancing on the edge of thriller genre.
Do you feel like it was something you learned in that class, or just the fact that you've been writing, you know, you hit your million words at some point in there, and that's when it, you know, things started to click?
Oh, I would say it was both. Yeah. You know, if I hadn't taken that class, I probably still was at the place where I was capable of writing something that was publishable. But that class, it mostly what that class did was help me focus in terms of, you know, on the ideas of mystery elements. It really was, and it inspired me a little bit too. You know, the instructor was a mystery writer and himself, and a really fun guy, and he, you know, he encouraged me. And sometimes it, you know, what you need as much as anything is someone to say, yeah, keep doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, we spend a lot of time by ourselves when we're writers, and so it's always nice if you get somebody out there who says, yeah, what you're doing is worth doing. You know.
Yeah. Now, when we, you know, you mentioned craft, and I love that word because it has so little individual meaning. So one of the things we wanted to ask folks on the show is, what do you consider to be your craft? Is it writing? Is it editing? A combination of those things? And then what do you see as your, what steps have you taken to improve that?
Well, you know, certainly where I feel strongest is probably in revisions. It's funny because whenever I see, you know, like writers on social media talking about, you know, revisions, editing, you know, I don't know if they're, you know, being, sometimes they're maybe being tongue-in-cheek or whatever, but you know, for me, that's when the process really is shining. I have, it's a lot harder for me to get ideas down than for me to refine and fix them, as it were, you know. I mean, Nora Roberts famously said, you can't fix an empty page, and I've got a lot of empty pages, I feel like, and so mm-hmm. If I can struggle my way through a first draft, then it really starts to click after that, because then, you know, what I'm doing is I'm looking at the pieces on the page, and I'm figuring out what works and what doesn't, moving, you know, the pieces around, often cutting. I tend to overwrite in first drafts, which is fine. And, you know, I think, you know, it's whether you write a thin first draft and flesh it out, or overwrite a first draft and hone it down, you know, both of those processes work. I tend to overwrite, and so I'm really looking at, you know, how do I simplify? How do I sharpen? How do I cut? You know, how do I make this shorter? And all of my books got shorter in revisions. Curiously, Property of the State got longer, but it got longer during the developmental edit after it had been accepted for publication. The editor asked me basically to kind of add a scene and flesh out a few points, and so it was the first thing I'd written that went, you know, it gained words between when I thought it was done and when it was done. But early drafts that I had written myself were longer than what I submitted. So, you know, I still went through that hacking and slashing. And so really that's, to me, where I feel, you know, I'm at my strongest. The other part that is really, really fun to me is just that whole character development stuff. And I do a lot of writing on character, you know, kind of background and backstory that I'm intentionally know that it's never going to show up in a book. You know, I tell stories, I write diary entries, I write a character's autobiography as if they've been, you know, they're getting a write-up in the New York Times. You know, I do these kinds of things. These are ways that I explore character, and I try to use different approaches to the same character when I'm getting to know them, because I want to know them both as they know themselves, but I also want to know them as other people see them. And sometimes that means you create distance, and that's where I kind of, you know, I sort of like that New York Times, you know, profile approach, because I'm not just learning about the character, I'm learning about the agenda of the people who are interacting with the character, and that can really help when I'm putting them into scenes and story itself. So that's, you know, that's the other piece of it. And then, you know, the drafting is the hardest part, that first draft where it's just like, oh, like if other writers are going, ugh, revisions, I'm going, ugh, first draft. It's always nice to have something to fix, you know. I always felt.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask about, because when you're working, I mean, you have a lot of really precise sentences, descriptions. Are you often shortening on a sentence level, or is it a scene level, or both?
I mean, it'll happen on a sentence level. And, you know, one of the things, a lot of times when I'm, and one of the reasons why my first drafts tend to be long is I'll be, you know, if I put a character in a room and I want to create a sense of space, I will describe everything in that room because I don't know what's important yet. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately, most of those details don't need to be there. And a lot of times the way that I even describe the details that do need to be there needs to be sharpened and refined. But in that first pass, I put a lot of effort into fleshing out that sense of space, or maybe fleshing out a sense of what the person's, you know, that a character is talking to looks like or something, you know. And I do that because, you know, a lot of times I often will say this, I don't know what a book is even about until the second draft. And so I don't know what's going to be important. I don't know what I'm going to need. And, you know, ultimately, when I am cutting, I'm cutting it down to that essential detail that because the character noticed it, it tells you something about the character, but also gives you a sense of space or a sense of time or, you know, whatever it is that, you know, that I am looking at that particular moment. You know, in terms of when I'm cutting scenes, I'm making them shorter because I'm hacking out details, but I'm also looking at how can the sentence get shorter? How can it get, you know, I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that Joey could be kind of Hemingway-esque, and I, you know, I'm probably not as extreme as Hemingway because I love language and I love interesting words, and so I look for ways to use those, but I don't want to bog down my story and language. I want it to be crisp and moving, and if a sentence is long, it's because it has to be long, not because I want it to be long.
Want to back out from that sentence level of craft and the drafting and ask about, I guess, your obsessions as a writer. What questions are you trying to answer with your work, or, you know, do you have a subject? Do you find you have a subject? I know you said you started in sci-fi fantasy but have moved to mystery as your primary writing now. Mm-hmm. Are there some themes you return to in there, or is there something about it in that bigger writer's project that you have a sense of?
Well, you know, I think that the one thing that crops up in all of my work is it tends to be about, on some level, abuse of authority. That's a topic that, obviously it's something that Joey struggles with in Property of the State. He's got abuse of the authority of the, of his foster family. He feels like, you know, he's being, you know, run roughshod by the cops. He's got all these kinds of things. And as a writer, that theme comes up for me over and over and over again. And even, you know, in my adult mysteries, that remains a theme. And sometimes it's about the conflict that people in authority have with their own authority. You know, my adult character, Skin Kadish, is a police officer. He's a police detective, and there's some inherent authority that comes with that. He both fights against authority, but also acts from a position of authority. And sometimes he's unaware of the way that maybe he's acting that he would criticize someone else for. And those are things that I like to explore. I think, I'm not inherently opposed to people being an authority. I think, you know, good leadership is critical in all kinds of settings. But I also think we see all too often where leaders either consciously or unconsciously fail as leaders, and whether they're parents. I mean, parents obviously are leaders, and parents can, you know, you can be a great parent, you can be a weak parent, you can be both. I think, you know, the best parents are actually both, because when they make mistakes, they own them, and they help their children learn from them as they learn from them themselves, you know. But, you know, even the most cavalier person can have, can make choices that impact others from an authority standpoint. So I'm constantly exploring the idea of of authority. You know, obviously in Joey's case, it's adults who have failed him. In my adult novels, the authority that's failing is something else. But the other thing that I try to do is not just be, a one note. When, if there is an adult who failed Joey, there's an adult who helped him, who was there for him in a really important way. If there's an adult who, or if there was an authority figure who overstepped their bounds, in one of my adult novels, there are authority figures who use their authority and their leadership in a positive way to make things better for others. And so I try to show balance in that sense, but I'm definitely tackling that as a theme over and over again. And I have a feeling it's going to stick with me. It seems like it's been pretty important up to this point.
That's a good one to chew on.
Yeah. I think it's always timely. I mean, you look, throughout history, it's a dynamic of authority and overstepping authority or failure of authority when people have authority and don't exercise it when they should. Mm-hmm. So it's, obviously that's sort of a really big picture concept, and I'm going to drill down to, ground level whenever I tackle it, but, that is my 10,000-foot view that I'm looking at.
One thing that I was curious about was in researching different, speaking of organizations, Marty, when you do research, how do you do that to be economical about it? Because I know you've done a lot of police ride-alongs in the past, mm-hmm. and things like that. How do you do that in a way if you only have so much time to get the information that's going to help you and get to keep coming over and over?
Yeah. Well, one of the things, with the police ride-alongs in particular, the way that came about when I was working on, I was actually working on Chasing Smoke, my second book. My first book was in edits at that point, and I realized that it was a mystery novel that featured police work. And I had done research for that book, like basically reading stuff, and some of it online, some of it, buying books on police procedure and things like that. And generally, I think the police procedure was pretty good in that book. It wasn't real important because it was told from the point of view of not from a cop, but of an ordinary citizen. And so he was seeing everything, from the outside. And if I got things wrong, it could be as much because of his misinterpretation, what he was seeing. But when I started on the second book, I realized, I'm writing from the point of view of the police officer, and that means I need to understand what they're doing. And so I, at that point, became a lot more intentional in my research. Instead of just reading a little bit and hoping that I get the words right, it was about understanding how people do their job and how they, kind of how their brains are working while they're doing their job. And the only way to do that in this case was to hang out with police officers. I was living in Portland at the time, and I had a really, really great opportunity to participate in a Citizens Police Academy, which is basically a 10-week class that met on Wednesday nights. And for 2 hours, we got basically a summary of what police officers in actual police academy would have been studying during that particular week of academy. So they, they spent 5 days, full-time hours. We spent 2 hours, touching upon all that things. And that was a really valuable tool. It did take some time. It took 10 weeks, and I was 2 hours or maybe 3 hours a night once a week, plus a lot of extra reading. But it was really valuable because I got to, I was talking to cops in the classroom every week. And then I got to know some, and then when I requested to do ride-alongs, I had some names where I could say, I met this officer, if he's got space, and they have to be able to do it, and it's not always something that they can do. But what I was trying to do in that case, at that point I had the procedure down pretty good, but spending time with the police officers meant that I understood how they approach their job better. It wasn't just what are the steps that they take, but what kinds of things, what were they talking about while they were doing it? And one of the things that I found out is they were talking about the kind of stuff that I was talking about with my friends, like, oh, my kid at school last week, and oh, I'm working on the basement, and I, found out that the plumbing has, it was a great chance to see, you know, them as human beings, where a lot of times when, you know, as citizens in the world, we see a police officer and it's just a person in a uniform that, you know, could give us a ticket or worse, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and if we're lucky, they'll just ignore us. And so, I mean, that aspect of it was really important. You know, obviously that's not available for everything that you're going to research. Police departments generally like to do ride-alongs because it's really good community outreach, and so you find that that's available. You know, that kind of thing was not available for a children's services caseworker because there's confidentiality issues, you know, there's privacy issues, and the best that I could do there was, in that case, I did an email exchange with a caseworker who basically answered my questions, really eager to answer them. You know, what you find in almost any field is people love to be able to share what they know. They love to share their expertise. But there were points where they said, you know, they wouldn't even do hypotheticals with me because they felt like that, you know, could be misinterpreted or, you know, could potentially compromise some kind of, you know, private information. So they answered questions at a very high level. But in that case, I had to kind of fill in a lot of blanks. And part of it was because I had some direct experience with foster care. My son, we adopted him through the foster care system here in Oregon. So we spent a lot of time on that. And, you know, and I got to see how they did their job from that, you know, from the perspective of a parent, you know, who was adopting a child, obviously. And that helped a lot, you know. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, Mrs. Petty is a really good caseworker, is because the caseworkers that I met were really good caseworkers. But I know that there are caseworkers that aren't so good because we see news stories about them. And so, you know, there's another side to that. But I, you know, I wanted to be, I think, true to the character. And I think that's all we can do in research, is we try to be true to the people that do the work. So we, you know, want to know the steps. Sometimes you can just pick that up on the, you know, on the internet nowadays. And then if you can talk to somebody, if you can ask some questions, trade some emails or meet for coffee, all the better. But you don't want research to become the thing that you're doing instead of writing. I'm working on my book. Well, how? Well, I'm going on another write-along. But what about the writing part? Oh, I'll get to that.
I'm reading Wikipedia for 4 hours.
Yeah. And, you know, and the research can really be a black hole. It can be a lot of fun, but you've got to, at some point, you've got to say, you know what, I know enough. I need to write the scene, you know.
Do you go back and forth as you're writing, or do you do a ton of research ahead of time? Or do you then, like, stop if you, you know, I don't know what's happening in the scene, or I need to know the specific brand of China or blah, blah, blah. How does that work for you?
I'll do a little bit of early research, especially if I have a sense of what the story is going to be. You know, if I've got a good plot and I, you know, sometimes what research does is it helps you identify plot points that aren't going to work because, oh, you know what, it turns out that no one would actually do this in the real world. You know, and so that can help. But I don't do a whole lot of early research. Instead, what I do is I make notes to myself as I go, and I'll be, you know, working on a chapter, and I'll just put a little thing, you know, look up X, look up Y, send an email to blah, blah, blah. You know, I've got a few contacts here and there where I can send emails off from time to time. And I just make notes because when I'm especially working on that first draft, it's so hard for me to get that first draft done that I don't want to trip myself up by falling into the research black hole. So I just make all these notes. And then when I'm working on the second draft, one of the first things I do is go through and look at those notes and say, okay, I need to look up X, I need to look up Y. And sometimes what I learn is that, oop, I made a plot decision that I need to refine. You know, it's hopefully I've done enough research in advance that I don't have to throw an entire plot element out. But and that hasn't happened to me yet, but it has happened where I've had to change the way scenes unfolded and developed because when I did look up X or send the email to, you know, whoever, they came back and told me, oh, yeah, couldn't happen, wouldn't happen, you know. You know, and as I've gotten more experience as a writer, I've researched less, not because I think I know enough, but because I've come to realize that you don't actually need to know that much in order to convincingly, you know, show a situation, unless you know, obviously if you're writing a Tom Clancy techno-thriller, you need to be kept up with the latest in, you know, weapon systems or whatever. You may need to really do a deep dive on that stuff. But, you know, unless you've got a particular plot that really relies on deep knowledge of a particular subject, sometimes you just get a few basics. You get a sense of how people do their jobs or do, you know, interact with people in their jobs. You put it on the page, and then you ask someone to take a look at it and tell you if they got anything wrong. And that way you're spending more time writing and revising than you are, you know, on research that you'll never use.
Oh, it's so fun and tempting.
It is. It is.
All right, I'm going to change direction slightly, if I might. We're starting to come down on the end of our time. So I do want to ask you how you manage the business of being a professional author, published author, Bill Cameron, versus the writing life of Bill Cameron. There's, you know, a lot of talk about how much work writers have to do now, that the publishers don't do it all, or if you're indie published, you have to do a ton, you have to do all the work.
Right.
How do you manage those two sides of your life?
Well, for me, part of what makes it easy for me to balance those two is, you know, my day job up to this point has also been in a creative field as a freelancer. And so I've got, you know, that gives me the advantage of having certain business systems in place. You know, I know how to, you know, it's not that I have to write invoices as a writer, but I have QuickBooks and I, you know, I keep track of expenses. I'm really good at tracking expenses and tracking time and things like that. So that really helps, because even though the two don't mesh up exactly, I'm already thinking of myself as a business person doing a business person's job. And then what I do in terms of the writing versus the writing specific business aspects is I really focus on, you know, kind of where I'm at in the process right now. So, for example, you know, Property of the State came out about a month ago, and starting about 3 months before that, I started to think more and more in terms of shifting my time focus away from other things to the marketing component, because you need to prepare for, you know, set up appearances if you can, you know, bookstores and things like that. You need to, you know, write blog posts. You need to, you know, there's, you can sort of a whole long list of stuff, and that can really bog you down. And so I intentionally didn't start doing that until I was, like I said, it was about 3 or 4 months out. And I did that because if I'd started it too soon, I would have spent a lot of time on it and not got any writing done. And if I started it too late, then it doesn't get done. So, you know, over the course of, with this being my fifth book, I've kind of figured out that that was the sweet spot for me. And there was a point where, as the release date got closer, where I said, you know what, I can no longer write until after the book is released because, I still have a day job, you know, so I got to fit in that. You know, it's going to take me 5 hours today because I need to write X number of emails and I need to, you know, I'm reaching out to bookstores, I'm reaching out to libraries, I'm reaching out to, you know, I'm setting up giveaways. There's a lot of little things that I did. And, you know, and essentially it's all about time management. So, you know, I've got a to-do list. I have my to-do list prioritized. I do it for my day job because I, you know, when you're self-employed, you have to stay on top of it if you want to be successful. And so that just translates right over. Another thing, you know, I am traditionally published, although I do indie publish short stories at times, and I have rights on my first two books have reverted, at least partial reversions to me, so I've done indie second editions of those in various platforms, but because I'm traditionally published, one of the things that I don't have to spend as much time thinking about is the stuff that my agent thinks about, and that's really nice for me because I know that she's, you know, we're business partners together. She wants me to be successful, so she'll be successful, and so she and I, you know, I let her do her job, and I also let her tell me when it's time for me to do something that I need to do. So, you know, if you are traditionally published, you know, hopefully you've got a good relationship with your agent, and you two can you know, work cooperatively. I know not everybody has a good relationship with their agent, which, you know, is, you know, it's unfortunate, obviously. I've been really, really lucky. My agent's great. I love her to death. you know, and if you're indie published, you're probably, in terms of that time management thing, you've got a lot more on your plate. You know, when Property of the State, you know, I didn't have to worry about the cover design because I didn't get any say on it. I mean, I got a little bit of say. They did a great job. I was so happy with it that I didn't really have much to say. You know, it's just like, wow, I love this.
Is it safe to talk about the actual photo? Is that okay?
What's that?
Is it safe to like mention where the actual photo came from?
Well, yeah, the background photo on the cover is one that I took from Mount Tabor Park in Portland, which is from the scene of the house where Joey is hiding out, and I sent it to the designer along with some other photos, and those are just my reference photos, and he liked it so much that he used it in the background of the cover. So I was really excited about that. But that was, if he hadn't done it, it's not like I would have been able to say, use this photo. It was more like, this is just sort of give you a sense of space if you want to, you know. Property of the State is a Portland story. It's got a lot of Portland character to it, and so I thought it was worth him having. If he hadn't used it, I wouldn't have even thought twice, because it really would never have occurred to me that he was going to in the first place. <You know? laughs> But he did such a great job that mostly I just got to say, I love this. But if you're indie publishing, you're going to be a lot more responsible for that. And it may be, you know, maybe you're designing it yourself, or maybe you're hiring it out. I mean, you've got to leverage your skills and your time. And, you know, if you're a designer, great. But if you're not a designer, you're essentially creative directing a designer, and that can take a lot of time, so you've got to fit all that stuff in. Obviously, you've got to fit in, you know, the other pieces, like, you know, working with your copy editor and your developmental editor, you know, whoever you hire for those kinds of things. And as, you know, with traditionally published books, there's less of that responsibility on me, and I'm glad that that's true for where I'm at right now. You know, if the time came where it made more sense for me to do something in a more indie vein, at least I know what's required. You know, both from, you know, the friends that I have who are indie published and are doing all of that stuff themselves, I'm seeing the amount of work they're doing, which is huge. But then I've also seen, you know, I get a sense of it just from how my own books have been handled over the years. So, but yeah, you know, it's time management. You know, it's making a list. It's saying, you know, at this point, I've got to focus on X, because if I don't, when I get to Y, everything's going to collapse. You know, I'm not going to meet my deadline. You know, and traditionally published people have those deadlines too, but they may be different deadlines. They may be, you've got 6 weeks to respond to the developmental edit from your editor. You've got 3 weeks to go through the copy edits and, you know, okay or step them, you know, the changes. And then after you stead a bunch of changes, then you've got another week to go in and explain why, even though you steaded them, they made the changes anyway, and you know, you've got to make time to argue for why you steaded them after the fact. You know, certainly as an independent publisher, you have more say over that. If your copy editor makes a change that you disagree with, well, you're the one that's going to, you know, have the final say, which is both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing if you're confident, and it's a curse if you get something wrong. But people are getting smart. I mean, the independent people that are following the independent publishing path, you know, their experience, you know, you just really see it in so many books that, you know, that I'm reading right now. And I know 5 years ago I would have said, you know, from my favorite books of the year that I read, maybe one or two would have been an indie, and I've had, you know, last year when I made my list of my favorite books, probably half of them were independently published. You know, it's really, it's an area that's matured, and it's because the writers are doing the work. You know, they understand it's not just uploading a Word doc and walking away.
So speaking of 5 years ago, can you let us know what your five-year plan is for what are your goals with the coming year?
Well, I am right now in the process actually of stepping back on my freelance job. It's not going to go away completely, but I'm cutting back on the amount of work that I'm going to put into that, and I'm actually going to kind of make up for that in the short run with just a regular wage job. But my goal is to increase my output. I figured out, you know, when you've written 5 books that have been published, that you may not know how to write the next book, but the one thing that I do know is I know how to finish a book, because I know I can. I've done it 5 times. I can't be sure it's going to be any good, but I know I can get to the end. And so now my goal is to increase my output. Instead of taking 2.5 years, you know, I would really my target right now is to be able to write 2 books a year. I'm going to start by finishing one and then finishing another. And but in 5 years, it'd be great if I was writing 3 books a year. I don't know if I'll get all the way up to 3. That's a big jump, you know, in terms of productivity. But that's, you know, part of why I'm slowing down on the freelance work and shifting into another direction, is so that I can have more time that I can dedicate to writing. Mm-hmm. And fingers crossed, but, you know, it's about committing, so.
Very exciting.
Yes, I am excited about it. It's a big change. It's a little bit nerve-wracking, but I'm very excited.
Mm-hmm. I hope that works.
Thank you.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time. Geraldine, do you have another question? Or?
We are going to try this. We'd like to end our interview with a little spot of inspiration for those who are listening and striving to master their craft. So do you have a last piece of wisdom to leave to listeners?
I can't take credit for this. I've heard it many times, but it's so true. You've got to give yourself permission to suck. You've got to do it, because if you don't, you're never going to get the words on the page to begin with. You've got to let it flow. You've got to let it pour out, and you've got to be okay with the fact that it's probably going to have to be changed. I have a lot of respect for people who write clean first drafts. If you can, wonderful, good for you, but don't assume that you have to. Just get the words down. You know, you can fix the words after the fact. You know, on my website, I have a note at the bottom of every page that says, you know, revisions are when you get to move the darts onto the bullseye while no one is looking. And that's really how I feel about it.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay, well, how can readers and adoring fans find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter a lot. My Twitter name is BC Mystery. I am a lot less frequently on Facebook. I sort of forget Facebook exists for weeks at a time, which is just kind of the way my brain works, but I will crop up there. My website is bill-cameron.com, and I also am a blogger at YA Outside the Lines. I do a blog once a month there. So I had forgotten about that until just this second, because my next blog is tomorrow, and after we get off here, I'm going to be working on that. I've started it. I've got to finish it up this afternoon. So,
what is the best place to find Property Estate?
Well, obviously, all the online places have it. It's available in all the major ebook platforms. So, you know, Kindle, Nook, iBooks, and Kobo, and all of that. Barnes & Noble. I know they've got them at the Barnes & Noble here in Eugene, and I've heard tell that they've cropped up in other places. Seattle Mystery Bookstore has a bunch of them if you're in Seattle. That's a great, great shop. The Book Bin in Salem. I plug in these bookstores because they've been so great to me over the years. So, and they're wonderful stores. Another Read Through in Portland has them. And I've heard tell of people stumbling across them, you know, in New York City. And you know, that's really gratifying when you've got, you know, widespread distribution, for sure. So
very cool. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today on our inaugural podcast. We really appreciate it. Take care.
You too.
Take care.
Bye. All right, bye-bye.